Hello, this is Justin Veach, Associate Director of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear Dr. J. Craig Venter, the scientist who was the first to read and interpret his own genome, discuss his memoir, A Life Decoded, in conversation with Dr. Michael W. Quick, professor of biological sciences at the University of Southern California. This program was originally produced on Thursday, November 8, 2007. For more information on Aloud, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Join me in welcoming our special guests, Dr. Craig Venter and Dr. Michael Quick.
Thank you, Betsy, for that great introduction. That was very nice. I want to thank you, Craig, for being here. I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank my parents for making my presence here possible. I want to thank the Council of the Library Foundation for sponsoring this and the City National Bank also for their kind support of this program tonight. Boy, there's so much to talk about, and we only have such a short amount of time to do it. Craig's new book, the Institute, some other ventures you have going on with synthetic biology that I want to talk about. I hope we get a chance to talk about sailing and surfing. The general hell-raising that you do, both in science and out, so this should be a lot of fun. And I look forward to talking with Craig and also having you in the audience participate as well. Okay, let's get to it. You recently published what we call in sciences the diploid genome. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is and why it's important and what it's going to lead to?
Well, the diploid genome is our complete genome. It includes the sets of chromosomes that we get from both of our parents. What was done in 2000 and 2001 was essentially half a genome, the haploid genome. The thinking was if half was going to cost $3 billion, well, we better settle for half, thinking that the other half would be easy to infer. But it actually came up with a lot of naive assumptions, so one of them being that we all have exactly the same set of genes, and we only differ from each other in 1 out of 1,000 letters. So now with the complete genome, the full diploid genome, we know that we differ from each other in 1 to 2%, which is a very big difference. To put it in context, we thought we differed from chimps by 1.27%. So if we differ from each other by 2% and chimps by 1.27, we have some explaining to do. But
I think I know who those people are,
actually. For my former colleagues.
That's why they're former colleagues, I guess.
That's right. Well, they went ape when they heard these numbers. So it's, but in fact, fortunately, the second number changed as well. We're 5 to 6% different from chimpanzees now when you take the entire genome into consideration. So this is very important, and it gets us on the right road to understanding genetic differences across our, 6 billion people, soon to be 9 billion people. And we had trouble explaining that 7 years ago. Of why we look like we're all essentially clones. So I was relieved by the number and yet surprised by how different it was.
Yeah. So one of the things that came out of the haploid genome work was that, there were a lot of guesses about how many genes we would have, as if the number of, the more genes you have, the more important you are as an organism or something like that. I'm not sure what that, but we heard numbers like 60,000, 80,000, and it turned out to be 20-some thousand.
Well, we initially thought it was 26,000, but when we eliminate pseudogenes, the current number is around 23,000. Actually, a couple of companies claim they patented 300,000 genes, so it says something about them and the patent office. Many people were upset when we only had twice as many genes as a fruit fly. A lot of Drosophila geneticists were very upset as well. But they didn't feel the flies were that insulted by it. People wanted there to be one gene for every trait and every function and every disease. Also, a lot of people wanted us to be very different from any other species. And so they were disappointed all the way around. But 23,000 is a big number when you have it in 100 trillion different combinations.
Right.
We don't need lots of genes. I'm glad biology is not as linear as people were hoping that it was.
Yeah. And then, of course, we have the whole, I mean, it's not only genes, of course. We always have had this nature-nurture argument. And, of course, the answer always to a nature-nurture question is it's somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more than just the genes. There's the environment that works on us. There's the, you know, the what we now call the proteome, all these proteins that are being made. So clearly there's a lot of potential for a lot of different variation going
on. Well, in fact, identical twins really aren't so identical. They can have identical genomes, but when you go from one cell to 100 trillion cells, there's so many random stochastic events that you never get the same answer twice, no matter how many times you run that experiment. That's why twins don't have the same fingerprints. They have quite often different body sizes, all kinds of variations that people like to ignore because they like to stress the similarities. But the genetic code is part of the equation. We're trying to find out what part it is. We're setting up to do 10,000 human genomes over the next decade. The genetic code is part. We want to have complete clinical records, phenotypic information, life outcome descriptions, trying to get to a scientific basis of what is nature and what is nurture. Mm-hmm. We are very much a genetic species. Almost every human trait is going to have a genetic component, but it's also this fine line because they're also going to have environmental components. And we've shown with the most basic, simple cell that, in fact, you can't define an organism based on its genetic code alone. The environment is equally important.
Absolutely. So in this latest, when you've looked at your own genome, because it was your genome that the diploid genome was published on, and you were one of the ones in the haploid one, but in the diploid one, what were some of the things for yourself specifically that came from looking at your genome that surprised you?
Well, even simple traits, there's boxes in the book where I go through and separated them out, the descriptions of different genes, the science behind them, and what they might mean or not mean. For example, eye color. Most people look at their parents or siblings, try to understand genetics of eye color. It's not one gene that determines it. In fact, there's many different factors that come into play. You cannot tell from my genetic code that I would have blue eyes. I have a high statistical probability of having blue eyes, but I try to use things like this as a message that's what the genome's going to give us, is probabilities, not yes, no answers. So I was actually surprised by that, looking into it. But I think other than the human-to-human differences, a big surprise was that 44% of my genes, 44% of the 23,000, have a heterozygote variant in it, at least
Uh-oh,
one.
What does that mean?
It means of the two copies, there's at least one of the two copies in the gene that's variation, or the gene doesn't exist at all. Hmm. It's part of this notion that it's called copy number, that we don't all have the same genes. In fact, one very important gene for detoxifying environmental toxins, only a third of the Caucasian population has any copies of that gene. A third has no copies, a third has one copy, and the other third has two copies. It's an example of we don't all have the same genes. Maybe that's one of the ones that could potentially increase the cancer risk or not. We're trying to understand all these multivariate components.
Yeah. So now that your genome is actually published, are insurance companies looking at your genome and saying, we can't cover this guy now because we're looking at various genes and we see that, oh my God, he's destined for a degenerative disease or he's destined for cancer. And this just leads to the real question, which is, how do we think about the relationship between our genomes and what's going on in the public sphere?
Yeah. I haven't gotten any calls from my insurance company, but it is an important issue in terms of how the information gets used. The insurance industry, as I've talked to them, has been sort of split on it. In many respects, we want the insurance industry to use this information going forward, because if we're going to switch to a preventative medicine paradigm, we want the companies to understand the risk and the benefits. If everybody in this room had their genome sequence, we would all find that we're at risk for something. So nobody would be immune from it. It gets us back to the common shared risk. But if the insurance industry, which is one of our major third-party payers for healthcare, understands the cost-benefit ratio of preventing disease, that could be a major benefit to all of us. What we need is just some simple protections against genetic discrimination. There's been a bill pending in Congress for years. It passed the Senate. It has a couple hundred co-sponsors in the House, but the Republicans won't bring it up for a vote. Both pharmaceutical and insurance companies are, you know, don't want this to pass. But I think the biggest issue is employment, from my point of view. Not that I'm worried about my job, but that using genetic information as a discriminatory tool in employment is certainly the biggest concern I would have, not because it should be or is even useful for that. It's because until we establish the science across the community of what this data actually means, people are going to be acting out of prejudice, out of ignorance, and that's usually the basis for most discrimination.
Right. So I want to get on to some of these other very interesting things you now have going on in just a second, but I just want to sort of finish up with a couple things about the human genome. And one is, I noticed there's a big push for coming up with the $1,000 genome. Can you kind of give us a sense of, you know, wouldn't we all like to have our genomes available? But how far away are we on that? How expensive is it? How much did it cost to actually have your genome done?
Well, the number has been as high as $70 million, but that's in part because part of what was done is the Celera experiment.
Right.
So, but it costs at least an additional $10 million with the much more complete data we've added on. But we're now using a new technology that we're trying that looks like it could lower that to $300,000. Some people think within a year or two it would be $10,000 or less. I'm part of the XPRIZE Foundation, so we have a $10 million cash prize for whoever develops a new technology to get us down to the $1,000 genome. So if you'd like to earn $10 million, I'd love to give this award away.
That's great.
So that we get there. We picked the $1,000 sort of arbitrarily. What we want is the technology to be broadly accessible to the world population for as quick and as accurate sequencing as low cost as possible.
Yeah. So one of the things I often hear when people talk about the genome, they say things like, you know, if we get to the point where it's a $1,000 genome, now we have unlocked the ability to do real personalized medicine. People will be able to look at your genome, see certain things in your genes that will allow you to, you know, provide better healthcare service to people. And then I think back to the war on cancer, and I think back to which was way before my time. I think back to the 1980s when we were talking, when genes first started getting cloned, and we started to talk about rational drug design, that by knowing what a receptor for a compound looks like, we'll be able to design a compound, and that will help us treat diseases. And now I see it with stem cells, where we say things like, oh, well, stem cells are going to do all this wonderful stuff. Do you think we're overpromising?
Well, in part, the scientific community is forced into that a little bit, particularly when things like doing research on stem cells get so politicized. You have to offer what the hope is and the promise for doing it. The reality is we can't understand or interpret the human genome unless we can understand how stem cells work. They're the interpreter of our genetic code. They're what take this linear chemical information and create cells and tissues. Most of the people that are talking about the cures and treatments for things like Parkinson's do that with the hope that it could go in that direction. But when science gets politicized, it's sort of forced in that direction. I always liked the term rational drug design because it implied it was irrational before.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
So it's
exactly.
And it has led to that in part. There just haven't been a large number of breakthroughs that have impacted things, but there's been a few.
That's true.
Gleevec is a great example of that. It's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor used for treating cancer. That was done on a rational basis of knowing things about the genome, knowing the genes involved. And now that we have the complete set of tyrosine kinase inhibitors, there's now hundreds of these inhibitors being designed against the receptors that could be perhaps sequencing the genes in cancer, as we're doing now, sequencing the tumor genomes. Have a set of drugs that could be used to inhibit growth of those cells. It just doesn't happen across the board. You know,
right.
Some of the promise gets met, but I think the government team was worried about defending their $3 billion budget, so it got hyped out of proportion. And one of my favorite quotes is from Sidney Brenner, Nobel Prize-winning scientist, one of the best scientists of this past century. He said he woke up the morning after the White House announcement and he looked around and the world hadn't changed, even though the genome had been sequenced. But it's a silent revolution in the sense that, as you know, I spent a decade of my career early on to isolate one protein, the adrenaline receptor, to finally get enough sequence to clone it.
Mm-hmm.
And now any student, any scientist can do that same experiment in 30 seconds, not only with that gene, with the entire repertoire of the human genome. So science is starting 10 years further on. It doesn't mean we get to miracle cures overnight, but 10 years is a big time to take off for each gene. And if it wasn't for sequencing the genome, the estimate would be well into the next century before we'd have the genes. So.
Yeah.
Science doesn't move in the way it's promised to the public, but it does move forward on a broad scale unseen to most.
You wonder, though, if the majority of the funding comes from the public through the NIH for funding biomedical research, let's say, that at some point it seems like we want to have some honesty in the process, in telling people what they can expect and not overhyping what we could potentially do.
I think it's actually more important that the public should be very upset that we're not having 10 to 100 times the rate of discovery because our government funding systems are basically broken. Maybe as a university dean, you don't see it that way because universities are so dependent on this money.
No, in fact, I have a card here where I was going to get into that, but let's do it right now.
Okay.
Let's do it right now. So why don't you give sort of a sense, your sense of what's broken and how you fix it. Yeah.
Well, what was touted is we have this wonderful peer review system where your colleagues look at all the sets of grants and decide what get funded.
Right. As a neuroscientist, for example, I think I want to work on a certain area. So what I do is I write a 25-page proposal, and I submit it to the National Institutes of Health for review. And they assign that work to peer review. So people who work in my area go to the NIH and they sit in a room for a few days and they read these proposals and they make a decision about, you know, which ones are worthy of funding and which ones are not. So that's sort of the peer review system that we're talking about.
But we have a system that's afraid to take risk, and that's the biggest fault that I have with it. A lot of excellent research gets done, but the research that gets done is very predictable, or it wouldn't have gotten funded in the first place. So I don't know if this emanates from just being a federal bureaucrat, or, you know, we used to have the Proxmire Golden Fleece Awards. You would pick a grant title and ridicule the government for funding this research. Whereas if we're not failing a certain percentage of time, we're not taking risks for moving forward. So while I've been successful in finding alternate ways when I couldn't get government funding, probably for every scientist like myself that's successful, there could be thousands or tens of thousands that their ideas get shut down. And we're not going to move forward as a society if we keep doing that. We're spending, as you mentioned, NIH alone, what is it, $20 billion in a safe way, and safe does not move anything forward in society. The best scientists cheat the system. You get a grant funded for what you already did, mm-hmm. and then you use the new money to do your new ideas. And we've all done that, but you're right. We should be able to be honest with the system and not have to cheat it to try out new ideas. So we have to find a way to change it. We have some agencies in the government that can do this. DARPA, for example, they feel if they're not failing with half the money, they're not taking enough risk. But I was on the NIH director's committee for a new award that he was giving for high-risk research. And several of us, there were several successful scientists that had taken some risk. We came up with a list of scientists we wanted to give it to. And all the high-risk ones, they thought were too risky. And so here this high-risk award went to very safe scientists that they already knew they were successful. So it doesn't work in the DNA of the government.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true.
So we have to find a way to try and change it, maybe having the money go out to agencies where, you know, they're mandated to fail half the time. But it's hard to do that and be accountable for the money when you're talking about $20 billion. So it's, but we have to find a better way to do it, or the U.S. is going to continue to fall behind the rest of the world, or we won't have the solutions we need. Now that we're a completely science-dependent society, we can't afford the risk to not take mm-hmm. the risk.
So where does venture capital come into this? Where do private firms, where do the private industry come in to do this? I mean, you found a way.
Well, science funding in this country has varied. Most scientists today think of the government first. Before World War II, the government was very little into science funding, and it was mostly private industry and philanthropic donors. Then after World War II, it shot way up, with a lot of government funding taking over. But now government funding is less than 50% of basic science funding in this country. So fortunately, we have very successful people like Bill Gates that create the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that now are giving away close to $3 billion a year. We have a lot of successful people in this country, and I have not seen it in any other country in the world where people give back so much to their own society. That plus venture capitals, plus pharmaceutical companies, plus energy companies, all trying to fund new ideas and things that the government won't do because they're too high risk. We should still ask more of what happens with our taxpayer money and try to find ways to move things forward.
Yeah. Let's shift gears and talk a little bit. Betsy mentioned you sailing around the world, which sounds like a nice job if you can get it. And but while you were sailing, you reached down essentially into the oceans and you pulled up some stuff and you decided you would sequence it. And what even brought you to think about doing that? And where are we now with that project?
Well, let me give a little background. My book is several stories. One is also a sailing biography. So I had my first sailboat in Vietnam. And I got it for doing a surgical procedure. And people seem to like this story because it's very different than maybe what you'd hear from scientists. The harbor master in Da Nang, for his first R&R, went to Bangkok. And he woke up the next morning with an unusual set of tattoos. And he had the name Mary tattooed across his fingers. And 3 months later, he was supposed to go to Hawaii for R&R to meet with his wife, whose name wasn't Mary. And so he was very desperate to have his tattoos removed, but in a war zone, you can't do elective surgery, and this was considered elective surgery. But I felt very sorry for this guy, so I surgically removed his tattoos and did skin grafts. And so he went to Hawaii as a war hero instead of becoming a casualty there. And he was so grateful he gave me a 19-foot lightning sailboat that I sailed up and down the coast off of Vietnam. I think I have the only lightning with the bullet holes in the sail. But so I graduated from that up to, very much in parallel with my scientific career of going first from small ponds to bigger bodies of water to oceans to sailing around the world, combining the best of two worlds of sailing and science. Just by after we sequenced the human genome, asking questions, what's the most important thing we could do in science and how could this technology contribute? And we decided that what we're doing to the environment, what we're doing by adding constant new carbon to the atmosphere, by taking it out of the ground and burning it, were probably going to be the limiting issues for humanity if we don't change it. So we first just tried to get a baseline to see what was in the oceans. The scientific estimates were there was maybe 100 times as much bacteria in soil as there was in the sea. People viewed ocean regions like the Sargasso Sea as a desert because there was low nutrients. Basically, we knew nothing about life in the oceans, even after 100 years of microbiology. So we decided to use the new lens of DNA sequencing to see what was there. So we took 200 liters of seawater, filtered it through tiny filters to get out all the viruses and microorganisms, just shattered them open, sequenced all the DNA together, and then used the computer to sort it out. And in a barrel of seawater, we discovered on the order of 40,000 new species in an area where there was supposed to be little or no life. And that was in the Sargasso Sea. And then we simply asked the question, well, if we sampled somewhere else, would it be the same or different? And that led, I always had the dream of sailing around the world in my own boat, and I thought, well, why not combine the two and follow on with the history of great oceanographic expeditions. The first major one was the Challenger expedition in 1870s, where the assumption was there was no life below a certain depth in the ocean. So the Challenger set out, because it was also when the first transatlantic cables were being laid, to send a dredge down to the bottom of the ocean every 200 miles and pull it up to see if they could find life. And of course, they found it everywhere, which surprised people. So we followed the same thing, taking samples every 200 miles. Why 200 miles? That's about as far as you go in a day in a sailboat. So it's a reasonable distance still 100 years, some odd later. And we found every 200 miles, 85% of the sequences and species were unique. So it means instead of the ocean being a giant homogeneous pond, it's millions and millions of microenvironments constantly changing. Even more important, we found that most of the organisms in the top layer of the ocean have the ability to get their energy from sunlight. They have visual pigments almost identical to the ones in our eyes that we use to see, only they convert the sunlight into electrical energy in the cells. And it turns out that's how they live in these low-nutrient environments. So instead of being a rare gene family, it turns out to be one of the most abundant ones on the planet. And we had no idea these mechanisms existed. And they're probably one of the major mechanisms for CO2 fixation in the oceans, as well as the diversity of life. So in one paper earlier this year, we described 6 million new genes, which more than doubled the number of genes in the public databases in that one study. And that was just from the first third of the expedition. So sometime in 2008, we hope to double that number again.
Wow. And I mean, those are amazing numbers, and it's, but this whole process is more than just saying, well, every 200 miles, look at all these genes we have. There's something even deeper than just going after cataloging the diversity that we see, or even making the recognizing that it's very nice that bacteria allow us to stay on their planet. So it's even more than that. So you have other things going on. So what, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in fact, we've been applying, I know where you're going, but let me add to it a little bit. We've been applying these same techniques to the air. So we're doing the Air Genome Project. We're pretty limited as a species. We can't see with our senses the majority of species on this planet. They're invisible. It's probably good that we can't see them. In this room, you know, each liter of air probably has 5,000 or 6,000 bacteria and maybe 10 times that many viruses. The air outside's not any better, so don't rush outside real quick. And so during the course of this discussion, we'll all breathe in thousands of bacteria and viruses. We sequenced the bacteria in the human intestine and found out we have at least as many bacterial cells as we have human cells in our bodies, on the order of 100 trillion. Each milliliter of seawater has 1 million bacteria and 10 million viruses. So if you don't like bacteria, you're on the wrong planet. We're definitely guests on their planet. And these are going to be important for understanding our own physiology, our own biology. When you measure the chemicals in the bloodstream, we only make, from our own biochemistry, maybe 2,500 different chemicals. But if you go after a meal and measure what's in our bloodstream, it jumps up to maybe 5,000 or 10,000 different chemicals in our bloodstream. This notion is we are what we eat is not quite correct. Most of the chemicals in the bloodstream look like they're the result of bacterial metabolites. So I'm trying to change it a little bit. We are what we feed our bacteria.
That's right.
And what they metabolize and feed us is a very key part of our chemistry. We're just learning this now. And so when we talk about the environment, we have to look at our genes, our cells, our immediate chemical environment from the bacteria that exist within us, the bacteria we breathe in. And so life's a little bit more complicated than most people thought. But he was, I think, trying to lead me towards synthetic biology.
Yeah, let's get into that.
So back in 1995, when we sequenced the first two genomes in history, one species had 1,800 genes. That was Haemophilus influenzae that causes ear infections in kids and meningitis. The other species, Mycoplasma genitalium, had only about 560 genes. So most of the advances I've made are by asking very naive questions. That's why when I get questions from audiences, they try to preface them that they're naive. Those are the hardest ones to answer.
Sure.
Is we just say, well, if one species needs this many, another needs far fewer, is there a minimal operating system for life? Can we define that? It was actually a very arrogant question for molecular biologists to ask. And part of the answer is you can't define it. As I said, we need the environment as well as the genetic code. And I can give you an example of this. We were trying to knock out genes in the cell to see which genes it could live without. And we do this by small pieces of DNA that are called transposons. They're like small viruses that will randomly insert in the genetic code. Our own genetic code is about one-third transposons, and they do move around all the time and change. But when a transposon inserts in the middle of a gene, it disrupts its function. So this minimal cell, or the cell that we've been working with, can live off of two sugars, glucose and fructose. And there's a gene that codes for a transporter for each sugar. And so if both sugars are in the environment and you knock out the glucose transporter gene, the cell lives quite happily. And so we would score that as a non-essential gene for life. However, if you only have glucose in the environment,
it's pretty essential.
And then you kill that transporter, the cell dies. And so you'd score that and say, that's absolutely an essential gene. We did this with 100 different genes that it looked like the cell could live without, but we knew many of them were conditional mutants or knockouts. So we decided the only way to answer the question would be to synthesize the chromosome from scratch, excuse me, where we could vary the gene content and see what it would take for the cell to live. Could it live without all 100 genes? It turned out it was a much harder question to ask. Nobody had ever synthesized a piece of DNA anywhere near that size. We started with a smaller piece, a virus, 5,000 letters long. But it was actually very cool when we went from the computer, and just to explain what we've been doing for the last 15 years, we've been digitizing biology. So when we sequence the genetic code of a species and put that in the computer, we go from the analog world of biology into the digital world of the computer. Now with synthetic genomics, synthetic biology, we can go from the digital world back to the analog world and recreate it chemically. So we went from the computer code, the digital code, we rebuilt the DNA molecule, we then put this inert molecule in bacteria, and it started making virus particles from that. So it's actually a case where the software builds its own hardware. And so we've been trying to adopt that, and now we've been building something basically a few hundred times larger, trying to build the first bacterial chromosome so we can try and answer some of these basic questions. And that's what has been in the press a lot as we've been making progress towards making a synthetic bacterial chromosome to boot up into a cell. There were two problems with this. One is, can you chemically make the DNA? And the other question is, what do you do with it? How do you boot it up and get a living cell out of it? And we decided the only way to do that is with another living bacterial cell. So earlier this year, we published the key experiments where we could take the chromosome from one species and purify it, get rid of all the proteins, take that pure chromosome, put it in another bacterial species, and then select for it. We put some markers in the chromosome so we could do that. And what happened is the species that we started with completely lost its identity. Its chromosome got chewed up and disappeared. All the proteins changed. All the characteristics of the species changed to that of the new chromosome that we put in. It's the ultimate in identity theft. You know, these two species were about as far apart as mice and humans. And bacteria, fortunately, have developed mechanisms to prevent this. Otherwise, evolution would have had a very different course. Bacteria have the equivalent of an immune system. They have restriction enzymes. These are the molecular scissors that cut up DNA. So they recognize DNA different than their own DNA. And we think that's, in fact, how we destroyed the original chromosome. So we have not done this yet with a synthetic chromosome. We're trying. The cells grow very slowly, so it takes about 6 weeks to do an experiment. But we hope sometime in the next several months that we will succeed, and we will have a cell driven by a chromosome made in the laboratory, mimicking what's in the native cell with a few changes. For those of you who like to write secret codes, we can have a lot of fun with this because the genetic code is 4 letters. So sets of 3 letters code for amino acids, and there's roughly 20 of those, each with a different designation of a letter in the alphabet. So when you make DNA synthetically, you can write words or sentences or we watermark the chromosomes, in fact, so we can prove that it was man-made, not the naturally occurring one. Aside from asking and answering very basic questions about biology, we don't even know how important gene order is in the chromosomes in a simple cell, let alone our own genomes. We thought these same tools could be very powerful for coming up with some of the solutions for the number one problem that I mentioned of putting carbon in the atmosphere. And we've been working on cells that will make gasoline, make diesel fuel or jet fuel biologically, starting either back with CO2 or starting with sugar. And we've made some good progress along those lines.
That's fantastic. So those are sort of two separate issues, though, right? Creating a synthetic organism, and then also, in a way, identifying the genes that are responsible for doing the kind of conversion one would want, taking sugars and turning it into gasoline or things like that. And so you're sort of pursuing both of those?
They're both in parallel. The synthetic chromosome is really a prototype to prove the feasibility in trying to answer some of the basic questions, but it makes you quite confident in the future. These are the tools that will be used to replace much of the petrochemical industry. Because you can design bacteria to do all these industrial processes.
Yeah, and you're so outspoken that of course you're going to get the standard. People pay attention to you, and you get that. There goes Venter again. This time he decided to play God. He's going to create life, and what? I don't find that a particularly interesting question, but one that is, I think, pretty interesting is this question of, if you can create synthetic organisms that do interesting things, you can also create synthetic organisms that do some pretty terrible things as well. And so there's a whole question of ethics and scientific appropriate conduct and making sure that we control those kinds of things in a very important way. And I know you've been interested in those questions as well. So where does that stand?
Well, in fact, this is one of the few areas of science. I'm not aware of any others where we asked for the ethical review before we did the first experiments. And so a team at the University of Pennsylvania spent a year and a half consulting every major religion, people in the lay public, really examine the questions of whether it was okay to try and synthesize life in the lab. And the only caveat was the concern about dual use of people abusing new technologies for biological warfare purposes, trying to do harm to others. But suggested that we should proceed on the reasonable basis that we were doing it. We've gone on to continue to do this. The Sloan Foundation gave us, along with MIT, a major grant for the last 2 years to really look at the policy issues, recommendations for what procedures labs should use to make sure anything that's made wouldn't grow outside the lab, which has been the standard for the last 30 years in molecular biology, with tens of millions of experiments being done and no accidents of any kind because of these controls that we use. The biological warfare question is a different one, and it brings up, something that's far greater risk in my mind, and that's new emerging infections. So I'm sure everybody's been seeing in the news how now the antibiotic-resistant Staph aureus has killed more people in the U.S. this year than HIV. That could be considered an emerging infection and is getting to be very troublesome levels. And we're going to see more and more of these from overuse of antibiotics and just new things emerging. HIV was a new emerging infection in humans. SARS, as we go from 6 billion to 9 billion people over the next 40 years is the prediction, we are definitely going to have more new emerging infections. I think that's a far bigger risk than anybody deliberately making infectious agents. But the solution is the same for either. We need new antibiotics, new antivirals, new vaccines at a time where, again, the government is not funding much in this area. Pharmaceutical companies are giving up this kind of research because it's not as profitable as treating chronic diseases. So either way, we need to find a way to change that, insisting government funds get redirected. These are national priorities, worries about a new flu pandemic. We've been fortunate in the last, certainly in my lifetime, I just turned 61. I had friends that had polio, but that got eliminated pretty early on in my lifetime. We've been pretty much separated from pandemics and massive infections. we have to be careful we don't let that come back. I don't think synthetic biology is the threat. And in fact, we're using these same tools in discussing it with groups to make combinatorial new vaccines and new approaches to getting ways to get at the larger problem.
Yeah. A couple more questions, then we'll open it up for the audience. So be thinking up of really better questions than I've been asking, please. But I want to get back to, you sort of made a comment earlier on about, you know, sort of the state of science in the United States right now. I guess I'll ask it this way. I'm not sure I want to actually do this, but this is to ask the question, how do we create more Craig Venters? Now, we could synthetically do it, I guess. That would be
Stephen Colbert asked me the same thing.
Did he really? Okay.
No, he said, how do we know this is the real one and not a clone?
Okay. But, but I mean it from the point of view of how do we get risk takers into the sciences? How do we engage young people to become, to want to be scientists, to strive to, you know, think big and do big things in science?
A lot of people, including myself, got turned off to science early on because it was taught as a rote memorization field with some pretty ugly terms to memorize that I've never used in my entire career. In contrast, just a week or so ago in the New York Times, Science Times, discussed a new school in Virginia where they're trying to teach science as problem solving. Mm. And that's what it is. You know, we're going out, we're looking at either how does this work and trying to work that out, or how do we solve this problem of global warming or heart disease? And it's turning people on to science in ways that never happened before. So I think we weed people out from science by forcing them into boring memorization of useless facts versus, you know, training people that it is a lot of fun, and solving problems is some of, and making these discoveries is some of the most exciting things anybody could do. And so we certainly need to try and change things that way. The trouble is, it's hard. It's like trying to get the NIH Director's Award institutionalized to go for high risk. It's easy to set up school standards when you're forcing memorization and regurgitation. It's much harder to teach problem solving and to try and standardize that. So I don't know how to do that on a broad scale. I argue I've succeeded in science because I didn't have all that curiosity driven out of me by the education system by avoiding it. But I think if we change our funding system and a little bit about the education system, you know, there's a difference between taking risks to ask questions that nobody asked before versus doing risky science. You know, my science has never been risky. Right. My career moves maybe were risky by challenging the establishment and taking things on. We don't want people to do risky science. We want them to ask questions and try and solve problems that we're not doing sufficiently today.
Yeah. One of the, and I'll finish up on this and then we'll take questions. One of the things that comes through in your book, and it's interesting to read, but it's certainly been my experience as well in science. I guess maybe at a more naive time in my life when thinking about science, I often thought it's this noble pursuit, it's this interesting collective, everyone working toward the common good of finding truth. There's a lot of bad people in science, aren't there? I mean, just people who will say...
And this is the dean talking.
people who will say, you know, I don't even care that I'm... It isn't even about the truth anymore. I want to get even, or I have an axe to grind, or all this kind of stuff. And of course, you know, we're all caught in that, because there's the business of science, and then there's science. And those two collide all the time.
Well, it's not just the business. I mean, it's the reward system. Some people are more motivated by the reward system, whether it's cash or fame or credit or, you know, a higher paid position at the university, whatever. And I think the race to sequence the human genome ironically demonstrated that scientists are very much part of the human race. They're not a breed that's separate from it. And that it's, you know, it's the ultimate irony that how much of the humanness got demonstrated in terms of greed, fear, jealousy, ego, you name it, it got demonstrated during that competition, mainly because it was the first time biologists had a multi-billion-dollar budget for a specific task. And unlike physicists, they didn't know how to cooperate. It's maybe people become biologists because they're much more individualistic. And physicists found a way to cooperate. In fact, they get a lot more money for their big programs than biologists do because of that. So it was much more Darwinian evolution of if somebody threatens your budget, you try to kill them. Maybe it's just biologists practicing what they preach, right?
Maybe, you know, it's, maybe.
But it does get ugly at times, as we see in every branch of science. And I mean, we've had scientists that go around with tape measures to see if somebody has an office that's slightly bigger than their office, right? I mean, scientists are human, you know. It's sometimes too much. So
It's a great part of the book, though. I gotta tell you. It's a lot of fun. Okay, let's open things up for some questions, and we're going to pass a microphone around. Okay, why don't we start over here? I saw this gentleman's hand up.
We're on? Good. Thomas Edison is quoted as saying, you know, I haven't failed 10,000 times on my light bulb filament. Instead, I found 10,000 ways that didn't work.
That's right.
And I'm wondering what you think it would take, for instance, to create a journal of failure that would study and report on all the different ways, and perhaps even be peer-reviewed, of all the ways that have been tried in science and engineering that didn't work, and or ways that can now be crossed off the list and don't waste your time trying this, or here are the unexpected discoveries that usually don't get published.
Yeah, I'm not sure adding a peer-reviewed journal on that front would benefit anybody. It's a... You know, I mean, how would you like it if your failure couldn't get published? You know, it's a you didn't fail well enough. You know, it's a you know, usually only the positive experiments do get reported, and that is a real danger. And it is important. You know, one of the arguments I make in the book, I know a great deal because I learn from my mistakes, and I make so many of them. A lot of people don't learn from their mistakes. And I try to learn from other people's mistakes as well, but you can only do that if you know about them. Otherwise, you're forced to repeat those same failures. But I think that's where the internet, you know, certainly is helping on that front, in some fields at least.
You mentioned the drug Gleevec and the way it works on cancer cells, on some cancers. Is it conceivable that any time in the near future we will have a drug that will be able to interfere with all cancer cells? Or are the drugs going to be pretty much designed specifically for specific types of cancer?
I think the answer is it's very unlikely that will ever happen, because cancers are all very individualistic. Cancer is a genetic disease, but it's not genetic in the sense that most of it is not what we inherit from our parents. Maybe only 3 to 5% of it is a direct result of inherited gene defects. Most of it is environmental, but it's changes in the genetic code that accumulate until the genes that regulate cell growth become dysfunctional. Tyrosine kinase receptors that I mentioned earlier are a key regulator of cell growth. There's a pretty good set of those, and they're different in different cells. That's one of the possible mechanisms. If you know which of those receptors are mutated, you can maybe select the right drug for treating those. That's one of the hopes now that could have a lot of benefit. Will that be universal to all cancers? No. I mean, so we need as many different treatment regimens as there are cancer types, probably, although some things are working across the board. The toxins seem to do that more effectively. But there's not going to be one simple answer for everything.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I'd like to ask a naive question.
Uh-oh.
Synthetic biology. If we start with the assumption that a strand of DNA is a living thing, and we know it's made up of a sort of like a high polymer of four different elements, and if we could, I would think it wouldn't be too difficult in the near future to be able to replicate a strand of DNA in a laboratory. Would we then be creating a living thing?
So let me correct you. DNA is just an inert chemical. It's not a living thing at all. It's like having a piece of software for your computer. It does nothing just sitting there. Your software only works when you put it in the computer and it gets booted up. So DNA on its own does nothing. It needs all the machinery to read it, to translate it, to interpret it for the cells, to go from the DNA to RNA to protein. But I think what you're getting at is, and I try to, every time I try to change these definitions, people argue that I'm splitting hairs. I don't view that we're creating life from scratch. We're creating new life forms by coming up with new genetic codes, but we're not building cells from inert chemicals from the beginning. To some people, those definitions don't matter. The fact that you can go sit down at your computer and design a new genetic element that changes the characteristics of a cell is a pretty mind-blowing concept to most of us. I think it's perhaps one of the most exciting ones that I've encountered in a pretty exciting career. But I think the definitions are important. Right now, we're doing, like all life forms, we're starting with an existing life form and we're modifying that. We're not creating new ones from scratch.
Yes, sir.
Do you think there's any merit in the concept of what's been called the histone code that supposes that some amino acid tails sticking out of the histones can read a metabolic field or a drug field and determine whether or not they unwrap and expose the DNA?
Well, there's so many different notions about this. So a key part of how our chromosomes get read for gene expression in different cells is those complex things called chromosomes unwind and open up so they can be read and converted into RNA. That process is not well understood. There's a lot of ideas of how that happens. I don't know what the answer is personally. It's part of the 97% or so of our genome that some people naively referred to as junk, because we didn't know what it was. It didn't code for proteins, and we're making constant discoveries as a scientific field of that junk is pretty damn important. And one part of it is that unrolls the chromosomes for gene transcription.
Hi, I have a question. It's me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. Imagine like if ever a perfect set of genes ever exist, like how would it be like? It might be a set of genes like never be get yield or never hurt by other things, by the environment, or like a set of genes that can have the best recovery system to interact with the environment. A little bit,
I'm not sure I understand the question. I've never mm-hmm. met somebody with a perfect set
know,
of genes.
I know,
but,
I know.
You're sitting next to him.
But oh my God. But my question.
I guess the question is how would you,
define how perfect the gene will be? Like, it's a set of genes that you can never get yield, like by physically, or like a set of genes that you can always recover from the yields, from the yield. Like imagine that you have a perfect gene, a set of genes, you like you're Superman, you're always strong enough, or like you have the perfect gene, like you just growing up, you can always recover and growing every time through the challenges.
You've been looking at my genome on the internet, haven't you? I don't think there is any such thing as a perfect set of genes. And
it's like a perfect immune system, or like a perfect superpower, like something.
Humans can strive for perfection in their lives, but not through their genes, I think.
It's like my question is, if for the nature, for the nature and the nurture issue, whether it's like the nature issue, like the gene, is that perfect enough for you to grow up without considering all the nurture issue, like the nature can always do the best interact with the nurture, something.
I think that's the big question, though, and that is that, you know, these genes don't sit by themselves without the nurture part. There's an environment, and these genes are always going to be interacting with their environment, so it's really hard to separate out. You know, you can't talk about the perfection of the gene because there's going to be always that question of how the environment comes to influence that. I think the best we can say is that evolution has somehow figured out a way to get us here and exist, and that's sounds pretty good to me, actually.
I mean, Richard Dawkins has talked about the selfish gene, and as we look at the environment and discover all these new genes, we begin to think of the world in a gene-centric point of view, not a genome-centric point of view. And species are just unique combinations of these individual entities, but there's no one perfect answer for everything. Some major gene families, we have 50,000 different members. Each one is perfect for its own situation.
Exactly. Can we have time for one more question? Well, why don't we take this one right here, this gentleman. Oh, hang on for the microphone.
Yes, I wonder if you could say something about the connection, if there's one, I'm sure there is, between the insights derived from your studies about the genome and aging, the aging process, and longevity.
I don't have much to say about that other than I think we're slowly uncovering, not me personally, but I'm certainly understanding aging a little bit more each year. you know, the process of cell death and whether that can be changed. It's something I've tried to deal with from my experiences in Vietnam of trying to understand one particular young man that was killed by a very small bullet penetration just to a small part of his brain. You know, we have 100 trillion cells. You can kill a very few of them if you hit the right neurons, and eventually all 100 trillion will die. Other times you could have a trillion or so of those cells die, and it doesn't affect the rest of the organism. So it's going to be very much dependent on which ones. In a multicellular species like we are, programmed cell death is a very important part of development. We have to understand it not only in cells, but the exact right cells that are responsible for whether we live or not a long time. I don't think it should be a major goal of biological research to unnaturally prolong human life. I'm worried how we're going to feed and provide fresh water and fuel for 9 billion people with existing lifespans. If we change that to 140 years or 150 or 60 years, it's not clear, or it's actually pretty clear the way we're going now. This planet would go downhill very rapidly if we try to do that experiment. But a lot of groups studying aging. They're not making progress fast enough for you or me, but...
Well, let's hope we take the years we have and actually just make them better.
That's right.
Betsy.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Venter. Thank you, Dr. Quick. They will be in the auditorium outside. They will be signing books. Thank you all for joining us, and have a nice evening.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay at Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KCET, and LA 36. A loud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.